Actually, the most important thing about supernova remnants is known by everyone in the room, and that is that supernova remnants are the result of the interaction between the eject of a supernova explosion and the surrounding ambient medium. And that is important because it implies that at least the young remnants must bear some imprint of both the physics of the explosion and the pre-supernova evolution of the progenitor. In this case, a type 1A field was that. Of course, this interaction takes place in the form of supersonic shock waves that heat the material to X-ray emitting temperatures. And that is a lot of fun because it allows us to observe them with Chandra and XMM Newton, and we get these beautiful images in spectra that I will talk about today. We've heard a lot this morning about how the physics of the supernova explosion imprints in the structure of the ejecta, the physical and chemical structure of the ejecta, so I will say no more about that. Now we'll go straight to the issue of whether we can learn something about that structure from the observations of supernova remnants. Just to put things in context, this is the Tycho supernova remnant, and the X-ray emission of this object has two very distinct components. These thin blue wisps around here, that's a non-thermal emission from the forward shock that's accelerating cosmic rays, and that is a fascinating topic that we'll have no time to discuss. It's just a power law. And all the rest, all this fluffy green yellow stuff, it's all ejecta emission. It's thermal and line rich. Now if you look at that ejecta emission, on small angular scales, there's inhomogeneities. For instance, that is a silicon-rich knot, and that is an iron-rich knot that was already noted by Tomek earlier on. But all in all, on larger scales, the ejecta emission is very homogeneous. You look at the spatially integrated spectra over large scales, it looks pretty much like that. There's no obvious asymmetries then in either the ejecta or the ambient medium emission. Just by looking at that spectrum, you don't need a PhD in astrophysics to know that, yes, there's iron and argon and calcium and silicon and sulfur and in the ejecta of this type 1A supernova. Yeah? Okay. Where was I? Oh, yeah. The thing, though, is to try to be quantitative about that. You know, qualitatively, it's very easy to tell, but how much of each element and exactly where it is, that's harder to know. And the reason for that is that the plasma in supernova remnants is a whole neo life in non-equilibrium ionization. That means that instead of having this nice situation where in collisional ionization equilibrium, basically the ionization state is determined by temperature alone, you have that the ionization state, and through it, the X-ray emission of the plasma is determined by this variable called ionization time scale, which is the product of electron density and time. If you have density and time, that means hydrodynamics, and essentially what you have is that the X-ray emission is coupled to the hydrodynamics. And you have to do this, in order to establish these connections between models and observations, you have to do these HD plus NEI simulations, and there's quite a bit of physics that's important to get right there. I will show you quickly an example of what I mean. This is an interaction of this particular ejecta model, which is a delayed detonation. With a uniform density ambient medium. If you do this calculation in 1D, there's only really three parameters that you can play with. One is the ambient medium density, the other is the remnant H, and the third is this beta parameter, which measures the amount of collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock. That's a variable that's not known from first principles for collisionless shocks. And I will not go into the details of what this calculation entails. Here you can see just the density and specific internal energy, mean ionization state, electron and ion temperatures, ionization time scale. The important thing is that to get from here to there, which is the synthetic X-ray spectrum, which is what you want to compare to the observations, you have to do all these things, and you have to try to do them right. So how do these models compare with the observations? That's of course the fun part. And when you try to do this for the Tycho supernova remnant, you find that you're very much constrained by what you know about the object. In particular, you know the age, so you can only vary the ambient medium density and the speed of parameter for the ejecta emission. That will allow you to match more or less the line emission if you're lucky. Then you have the other component of the X-ray emission I told you about. That's the forward shock component. But that is very simple. It's a power law with a known index. So there's nothing you can play there with. you can only play with the mutual normalization of the two components and the interstellar absorption. But it turns out also constrained in that, because you know that the interstellar absorption has to be around this value. You know that from X-ray and radio observations. And you also know that this power law has to contribute most of the continuum at high energies. So if you try to reproduce the observations taking different type 1a supernova explosion models, you find that most models just don't do very well, and that is because the structure of the ejecta is not right. We know, for instance, that the ejecta cannot be well mixed, as in a 3 deflagration model, because then it's impossible to get RNK and RNL and silicon K right at the same time. There is also a lot of thermal continuum that does not allow the forward shock to supply all this high energy continuum. That comes from the unburned carbon and oxygen that you see in this model. W7 has similar problems, less severe because here the ejecta are stratified, way too much magnesium. You see, for instance, that this model here, I forgot to say, also requires a very high value of the absorption. At the right value of the absorption, the RNL would be up here, and that is because there's too much iron in the outer layers. Even models that on first inspection don't look so bad, like the sub-trend detector model, if you look closely, you see it has no argon or calcium emission, and in the long run, you have to discard them. It turns out that the models that do work very well are the delayed detonations. And this model in particular can reproduce the line emission from all the most important lines in the spectrum, silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium, and iron. It does so at the right value of the interstellar absorption and also allowing the non-thermal power law to supply the high energy continuum, which we know from the observations has to be the case. But what's important here is that this is not only a synthetic spectrum that you're comparing to the observations. Underneath it, you have a hydrodynamic model. And that hydrodynamic model has to make sense when you get to the known properties of the remnant, that it's, you know, it has to give you the right dimensions, the expansion velocity of the ejecta has to be right, and the radial profiles of the line emission, at least qualitatively, they have to match. And this model can accomplish all that. I don't have time to go into the details, but you can find all that information in the paper. So now, if you satisfy yourself that you have a model that works well here and there, then you can be quantitative. And then you can say, okay, these are the properties of this particular explosion model that reproduces the observation. There's more, though, because as you know, delayed detonation models are a family of models. And this particular DDTC model that I showed you works well is this one in the middle. It's sort of medium to high energy. But there's this transition density from deflagration to detonation, which is the parameter that gives you this family of models. So you go to higher transition densities, this DDTA model. This produces a lot more iron. It's more energetic than DDTC and less intermediate mass elements. So you compare it to the observations, you see that it works well at high energies. But at low energies, the RNL complex is not quite right, and it's over predicting the absorption. It requires an absorption that's way too high. So in other words, there's too much iron in this model. You go to the other end of the delayed detonation family, and you have this DDTE model that produces a lot less iron, a lot more intermediate mass elements, and a lot more oxygen. What you have is that the model works well at high energies again, but it sort of underpredicts the absorption or requires the value of the absorption that's a little too low, and it overpredicts the oxygen line. So here you have too little iron and too much oxygen. That is nice in the context of what Craig was saying earlier. So there's something in the physical chemical structure of these delayed detonation models that looks right from the point of view of remnant observations. Now, I will start talking about a somewhat different topic later on. But now I would like to recap the first part of the talk to say that this HD plus NEI models, although they're not complete, do include all the physical processes that affect the ejecta emission in a direct way. And at least for the Tycho supernova remnant, they allow us to tell that the 1D delayed detonation models can reproduce the X-ray emission from the supernova ejecta, at least in the fundamental properties of it. And the other models don't seem to work, at least they don't seem to work so well. it's important to insist that the X-ray spectra and the remnant dynamics have to form a consistent picture. I mean, it's not very useful to reproduce one and ignore the other. As you have heard from Craig and from Paul earlier on, these results sort of agree with what you get from the type 1a supernova observations. But of course, they're completely independent of it. Of course, working in other type 1a supernova remnants, SN106 and on Kepler, and it's always interesting to include new explosion models. So if you model type 1a supernova and would like to know what a 400-year-old supernova remnant looks like, just contact me and I'll be glad to incorporate your models to our grid. There's something I just mentioned very briefly, but some aspects of type 1a supernova explosions can only be studied easily through supernova remnants, because here you can actually spatially resolve the structure of the ejecta projected onto the plane of the sky, and I'm not saying that this is easy to model, but this is the one place where you can see this and resolve it on small angular scales. Any details that you might wish to complete on that information are in that paper. Now, going on to the other part of the picture, if the supernova remnant arises from the interaction of ejecta with ambient medium, is there anything that we can tell about the pre-supernova history of the progenitor by the dynamics and X-ray emission of the looking at the dynamics and X-ray emission of the remnant? Well, that is the question that I set out to answer, and we heard on Tuesday very nice talk from Professor Hachisu on the accretion winds from white dwarfs in single degenerate systems. This mechanism is very important, and in fact, its importance cannot be overemphasized for type 1a progenitors in the single degenerate channel, because it's the only way that we know to avoid this final common envelope episode, which we want to prevent from happening at all costs, because we don't know how to simulate it. Now, the details of the binary evolution in a system like this, where you have this accretion wing, can be very complex, and there's people in the room that have simulated this. There's work by Ed van den Heuvel and Philip and Norbert Langer and collaborators. But one thing that's important, and Professor Hachisu did talk about this, is that these accretion wings do reproduce the observations of at least these two binary systems very well. Now, the properties of these accretion winds, at least the most fundamental ones, are the outflow from the white dwarf surface has more or less that those mass loss rates from 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. They're active for periods between several times 10 to the 5 to a few times 10 to the 6 years. And they have to be fast. And they have to be fast because they're from the white dwarf surface. They're outflows from the white dwarf surface. And they have to be the outflow velocity has to be at least equal or of the same order as the escape velocity from the white dwarf. Okay. I've gone through the literature and come up with very simplified models that sort of mimic the outflows from these systems. Those are 1D, spherically symmetric outflows, and they're continuous, so they're kind of simple, but bear with me for a minute. The question that one might want to ask is, what happens when these outflows impact the ambient medium around the supernova progenitor? Well, for that, you turn to the theory of stellar winds. Theory of stellar winds tells you that there's this critical velocity that you can calculate this way, and that outflows above that critical velocity are considered to be fast and lead to energy-driven cavities, which tend to be large. Outflows below the critical velocity tend to be slow and lead to momentum-driven cavities, which tend to be small. If you plug in some reasonable numbers for the warm phase of the interstellar medium and the accretion wind and the accretion in type 1a progenitors, you end up with this curve here. And what that is telling you is that since you expect the velocities to be around 1,000 kilometers per second, these accretion wind outflows are fast and are going to lead to energy-driven cavities. How large are these energy-driven cavities? Well, taking the simplified models I showed before, And this is the configuration for the circumstellar medium at the time of the supernova explosion. The cavities are indeed very large. We're talking about radii between 10 and 35 per sex. Yeno and other people were talking about ways to clear out the circumstellar medium or whatever is around the type 1a supernova progenitor. Well, this is very efficient. It clears out a huge cavity that is very low density. And now, the question that comes next is what happens when the supernova explodes inside this cavity. Well, what you see here is versus supernova remnant H, the radius and velocity of the forward shock. Okay, this striped region is what you get for the interaction of one particular supernova explosion, which one is not important as long as the energy is around 10 to the 51 ergs, and a uniform. And it's a striped region because I have varied the density to accommodate for the warm phase of the interstellar medium. And the dashed and dotted lines are the cavity moles. Of course, it makes sense. At a given age, you're going to have forward shock radii or remnants that are a lot larger, and forward shocks that move a lot faster. Now, the data points are the supernova remnants, the type 1a supernova remnants that we know and love. There's the four historical ones, SN1885, Kepler, Tycho, and SN1006, and there are the three ones in the Large Magellanic Cloud that have good age estimates from the light echoes found by REST et al. And you will see immediately that the objects tend to line up with the uniform interstellar medium interaction, and the cavities tend to be just too large. Now, there's some issue here with the forward shock velocities that I have no time to discuss, but the cavities are certainly on the wrong side of the data points. Another observable that you can compare with these supernova remnants expanding inside cavities is the X-ray emission from the shock ejecta. And what you see here is very similar to what I've shown before, but instead of radii and velocities here, I have the ionization timescale for silicon and iron in the shock ejecta of these remnants. They have all been observed with Chandra, except for SN1885 that has no X-ray remnant. And again, you see that the data points tend to line with the uniform interstellar interaction, and that the cavities are not doing a good job, and that is because if you have the supernova explode inside the cavity, the ejecta expand essentially in a free way until they reach the radiatively cooled shells, and then you have that the when the interaction begins in earnest, the reverse shock is propagating into ejecta that are very, very low density. And that's what gives you this very low ionization timescale. So let's recap what I've been saying so far. Okay, we have this picture where most type 1a supernova remnants, at least as far as we can tell, show no evidence of circumstellar medium interaction. And I want to be very clear that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Okay? There's a few remnants, in particular there's two, Kepler and N103b, that show evidence for some kind of circumstellar interaction. Certainly those accretion wind cavities, because that's too extreme, but there's something going on there. But that's not the end of the story, and that's not a complete picture, because you have to ask yourself what would happen if the supernova really exploded inside this low-density cavity. Is it large? It would be very faint, and it would be very hard to tell that it's a type 1a or not. And there are objects, and in this case, this is a remnant that's not very well known outside of the remnant community. It's called RCW86. This is certainly expanding into a cavity. It has iron-rich ejecta. Some people have argued that that is proved it's type 1a. That is extremely dicey in my opinion. But if this really was the remnant of supernova 185 AD, as some people have proposed, it would be young, and it might look a lot like those remnants expanding inside large accretion wind cavities that I've shown. Well, I mean, I'm almost done. So I recapped before the things that we learned about the supernova explosions, and now the things that we have learned about the supernova progenitors. We have this accretion wind models that are essential in our picture of the single degenerate mechanism that leads to type 1a progenitors. We have seen that these fast accretion winds lead to large cavities around the type 1a progenitors. That is really hard to avoid because the cavities are driven by mechanical luminosity, and the accretion winds have extremely large luminosities because they're very fast. The existence of such cavities is incompatible with fundamental properties of most known type 1a supernova remnants, in particular those six that have X-ray observations. But a population of type 1a supernova remnants expanding into accretion wind-blown cavities cannot be discarded. And RCW86 might be an example of that. At this stage, I don't think that we can tell whether this population is large or small or non-existent, but it certainly cannot be discarded. And more details about this work can be found in this paper, which was just accepted last week. And I think that I will finish.
Philip.
Yes, I agree with you that at the time of the explosion, the wind phase is largely over, but you still have a stellar wind from the companion star.
Okay, that's something I forgot to mention. I should go back to that. In particular, the models I took, where is that slide? Oh, here it is. Okay. The models I was trying to mimic, and some of them are from your work with Zhanwen and Han, are ones that have not a red giant companion,
right,
but a main sequence companion.
There are no red
companion.
Giant companions in that paper. So.
Yeah. So in that case, the stellar wind, if present, should be a lot less.
Right. But my other point is, you assumed it's a spherically symmetric wind.
Yes.
I would expect
a bipolar.
No, I would not expect it to be bipolar. I would expect it to be equatorial, because that's disk winds tend to be equatorial, and that's there are several observed cases like that. How would that change your analysis?
Okay, that is a very good point, and there's something I had it in the conclusion slides and just forgot to mention that we do discuss it in the paper. If the outflows are not isotropic, and in this case you would not expect them to be either because of the accretion disk or for some other, then you would lead to cavities that are, you know, not isotropic, and Professor Hachisa showed a sort of a cartoon of that. Now, in the remnants that I have shown, with the exception of Kepler and 103b, which are exceptions, that does not appear to be the case, in the sense that these objects are, the three on top are nearly spherical. Kepler is complicated. No? The historical evidence is very flimsy, because all you have is a light curve of pre-telescopic observations of people comparing it to this star or that star. For instance, the light curve is a lot better for Tycho than for Kepler.
I have actually, since several topics have been addressed here, I'm gonna comment about them. Well, the latest one on Kepler. I think the light curve, the records, the historical records are a bit worse than the ones of Tycho. But one thing that could point to a possibility of being a 1A is that inside you have, inside in the inner core of Kepler, we've been looking at this as we did with the Tycho project, the kind of stars that you had compatible with the distance of Kepler are kind of the same type of stars that you find in 1006 and also in Tycho. I mean, you don't find O or P stars, you don't find blue stars, but you have really evolved stars.
So it's a more or less old population, you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. And one thing this gives me the chance finally to comment, since I apply late for a talk, on what is the status of our findings on Tycho progenitor, and there are great news, and we are submitting two papers on this, and we have very high resolution signal to noise of around 100 spectra that have allowed us to finish the analysis of the abundance of the star that we propose as candidate for Tycho companion, and actually it's a subgiant star, 3.8 log G, temperature is kind of a G star, so it's kind of 5,900 kelvins. Subgiant, as I said, we have the age estimate like 4 giga years, and we find anomalies that make it compatible to have gone through several nova episodes before, like an overabundance of lithium of around 300 times the solar abundance, and other also enhancements in other metals. So I wanted to say that for people that were a bit desperate, so feeling uncomfortable about the situation with the progenitors of 1H, this project had allowed us to run to rule out totally the helium star progenitors in Tycho, allow us to rule out the red giant as progenitor in Tycho, and really gives the chance to the main sequence or subgiant kind of channel. And I would say if this at the end doesn't turn out to be the stars, although as you will see has some peculiarities, then of course we'll have to think of the double degenerate scenario as the last possibility. But I see what you said now concerning the wind and the talk that was given on Tuesday, to me is really compatible with what we are finding. But what I don't find clear from your talk is when you said the point that the three historical one is that you have over there, and you come to the same conclusion on the lack of on no evidence for circumstellar interaction.
It's not lack. I try to be clear about that. I say no evidence.
Okay.
Okay. As far as we can tell. By the way, this is not a historical remnant. This is one of the ones that have light echoes from the Large Magellanic Cloud. So it has an age estimate, but there is an error bar there.
Yeah. Well, the I concerning with I mean this question, I follow up your early work, and you said that the ambient density of the interstellar medium was very different. How can this impact your actually the results? I mean, if you have a very different ambient density when you blow up the star, you're gonna find everything a bit depending on the original ambient density of the medium. It's very different in 1006 than in Tycho.
Yes, the ambient medium density in 2000.
So how does this impact then? I mean, in disentangling the effects of the wind and the.
Well, okay, in the particular case of SN1006, you do have a very low ambient medium, ambient medium density, and some of the models that I showed, the cavities looked very different from all the objects except for SN1006, which was in a sort of transition. That is because the range of densities I include in the uniform ISM interaction model, those are for the warm phase of the interstellar medium. And SN1006 is way off the galactic plane, and it's just expanding into lower density. The case for it not being a cavity explosion is not so clear-cut as in the others. There is evidence that, well, it's in the paper, I'm not going to discuss it here because there's no time, that would make me very suspicious of any kind of circumstellar medium interaction, cavity or otherwise, in the case of SN1006.
Yeah, I had just 2 points on this. One is, of course, a lot of these have the so-called collisionless shocks, where we see the H-alpha emission and the broad H-alpha. And that's conventionally attributed to a neutral gas outside.
Yes.
So if you're looking for another constraint on the physical conditions right in the neighborhood of the remnant, there you are.
Absolutely.
What's more, that's another argument that for helping to decide which ones really are the type 1A.
Yes. Actually, during the program, we were talking about that with Kelly Korek, who is an expert in this kind of Balmer-dominated shocks. So yeah, and it's something that we keep in mind. And also, of course, Kirshner, one of the world experts as well in Balmer-dominated shock.
One more quick comment.
I'd like to point out that our model suggests circumstellar matter or the circumstellar discs around the...
Yes.
That is expanding velocities are very slow, like 10 kilometers or 100 kilometers per second.
Yes.
Now,
in all this work, I did not consider that possibility at all. However, The cavities that I'm discussing here are extremely large. The densities are extremely low. It all depends on how much matter you put in the center of that. Okay, if you have a low density wind that's actually capable of filling a 10 parsec radius cavity, then of course you cannot tell the difference between that and something where the where you're interacting with a uniform interstellar medium. But that's something that you would have to show is possible, right? The cavities are extremely large. Even if there was some matter at the beginning, then at the certain age of the remnant, the forward shock overcomes that, and you still have the problem of high radii and high velocities.
You mean the cross section is very small? You mean
yes.
Okay.
I'd like to thank our three speakers, and we'll meet back in half an hour.